get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Well, hello, this is Chris Grimes. Welcome to part two, very excitingly, part two of UK National Treasure, Michael Rosen, children's author and poet. Listen to part one if you've not listened to part, well, you haven't listened to part two yet, but make sure you listen to part one. That'll get extra context in what you're about to listen to. So buckle up, peoples, and don't forget to check out the Good Listening To Show new website at www.thegoodlisteningtoshow.com too, with details of how you too can guest through the various series strands and be on this show and be exposed to a large audience here on the UK Health Radio Network with an audience reach of about 1.2 million and growing. Anyway, I'll shut up because it's time for Michael Rosen. Enjoy. Welcome to another episode of The Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Something you've said in my researching is that death doesn't wear creaky boots, so you don't know who's going to go next, basically.
No, and that's a quote from my former wife's sister. That's right, when our son Eddie died, so that's Eddie's mum's called Susanna, and she went home, obviously, or immediately told her sister, and her sister said, death doesn't wear creaky boots. And at first I didn't know what it meant. It was so elliptical, poetical, imaginative, metaphorical, so incredible, personificationally wonderful and sad. And I remember Susanna explaining to me what she means is you don't hear death coming, you don't see death coming. Ah, it doesn't wear creaky boots. And I was so moved by it, and it was so appropriate for what had happened that literally Eddie just went.
Yes,
yes, I've never forgotten that phrase. It's so powerful. Yes.
And I know that was 1999, and again, right, a testament to your wonderful survival, because you've been through the whole gamut, absolutely the whole gamut of human emotion in what you've had to deal with. And yet you're still incredibly optimistic, vibrant, and you've found a way through.
Yes, my view on that is there's no point in being pessimistic, because you could be pessimistic, in other words, thinking life's going to be horrible, life's horrible, the rest of it, and then you could die. And then I sort of imagine this moment just before you die, and you go, oh, well, why was I pessimistic all that time when I could have enjoyed myself?
Yes.
I think, well, you might as well be optimistic, because at the end's going to come anyway. So there's no point in being pessimistic about it, because it'll come. So you might as well be optimistic and have a good time rather than be all glum and pessimistic.
Yes.
So my daughter once explained to me that I'm an optimistic nihilist. That's why you send your children to university, so they come back saying things like this. She said, the thing about you, Dad, is you're an optimistic nihilist. And I said, oh, hang on a minute, what's that? And she said, well, you don't believe in an afterlife, you don't believe in any deity or divinity, But you're very optimistic. You think to make the most of life as it is. And I thought, oh, wonderful. Thanks, Elsie. You've given me a phrase. You've given me a thing to describe myself. So I am an optimistic nihilist. So there you go. Yes.
And how long have you been sitting on the throne of optimistic nihilism in terms of her defining it for you?
About 9 months ago.
Oh, brilliant. Yes.
So she's just finished at university. She's just finished this June, I think. And so she's given me that little phrase, that little, it's not quite a portmanteau phrase, but that would be a word like smog, smoke and fog, that's portmanteau. But anyway, a little phrase that I can carry about with me in a thing like a portmanteau, whatever that is. Yeah. Do you know what Americans call a wallet?
No.
A billfold.
Ah.
It's good, isn't it?
It is good.
A wallet. I think possibly plenty of people know what a wallet is, but the word certainly older Americans say, they call it a billfold. It's wonderful, isn't it? Anyway, ignore that. And
I think of billfolds as being those sort of clips that you can put notes into. You know, that you sometimes get.
I think we call those a bulldog clip, don't we?
Well, for your money, it doesn't matter.
No, anyway, so
That was me going down my own rabbit hole there. Sorry about that. By the way, what I noticed you're doing brilliantly is you're lovely, in a beautiful way, you're melding what's shaped you into what's also been inspiring you. So this is a lovely time in the canopy shaking your tree. So would you now like to talk about any other things that inspire or shape before I move you on to the two things that never fail to grab your attention?
I'm always interested in songs and poems, plays, films. So I kind of I'm very porous. So it's probably just like all other people who write and so on, is that we look at this stuff and part of us is being moved by it, excited by it, amused by it. And there's another little bit in us going, oh, that would be fun to write like that. Oh, that would be interesting to write like that. So there's like a whole range of stuff. You know, if I watch Glastonbury, you know, which I do, or I watch Jules and listen to these singers, there's a young singer now called, I think she calls herself Cat Burns. Mm-hmm. I'm just like in awe. I mean, she's just pours out of her, or Loyal Kana, these people like that. And it just seems to pour out of them, these sort of autobiographical monologue-y things.
Yes.
And I look at them and I think, wow, that's just great. And so it sort of opens up like a little possibility. So it's a very general answer to your question, but it gives you an idea of when I'm watching somebody like Jules Holland's later with Jules, or Glastonbury or things like that, there is a little bit of me going, oh, yeah, no, you could. Oh, right, that's interesting. No, you could write that. So
there's your squirrels, as you define them. Just the you're always going to stop abruptly and just tune into that as to what they're giving you in terms of how they narrate their stories.
That's right. Yeah. I think many writers like that. So I'm not saying anything exceptional, but that is what I do. Yeah.
And you've described your own writing approach as being all about sparity in the end, you say, even though it's incredibly ebullient and spills lots and lots of meaning. You've talked about it being very spare.
Yes, it might be there's different styles, but one of the styles that I most experiment with at the moment is this spareness. And it's inspired, it sounds quite sort of pompous and grandiose, but it's inspired partly by the modernists, people like T.S. Eliot and, you know, the other imagists, the early T.S. Eliot, this is.
Yeah.
Though you get it in something like A Cold Coming, in the beginning of The Journey of the Magi. But he did a little set of poems about London, about London streets, called Preludes. Mm-hmm. And it's just got little things like, and the lighting of the lamps. And that may seem completely unremarkable, but if you look at the poem, four little preludes, they're called. And the first two of them are just these little snapshot pictures of London streets. And the imagists, those people writing just before the First World War, people like Ezra Pound, there's another guy called F.S. Flint, T.E. Hume, and American writers, H.D. and Amy Lowell. And there was a whole little movement of them, and they were in part inspired by ancient Chinese poetry. So there's people called Du Fu and Li Bai, I think he's called, and they wrote in this spare way. And certainly, that style helped me write about Eddie when he died. It's helped me write about hypothyroidism, and it's helped me write about my illness, and then also about quite comical things, and sometimes just like snapshots. I mean, I just tweeted something today. I was trying to eat a. I did it just earlier today. I am trying to eat a lettuce. No, do it again. It went, "I'm trying to eat lettuce with a spoon." Now, this may seem completely absurd and crazy, and surely there's a lot more to it than that. No, there isn't. But, of course, it expresses a certain absurdity of the kinds of things we're doing. Notice it's in the present. I am trying. So it continues. It exists before the poem. It exists during the poem. And it exists after it. Is it a poem? Well, sentence. I am trying to eat lettuce with a spoon. And so I can see now off the tail of this, there's all sorts of people going, why are you doing that? Why do you know, the best thing to do is put it in the microwave. Oh, there's hundreds of responses to it. And I think I've actually written a good little poem because it's had lots and lots of responses. And because it's slightly mysterious and intriguing and utterly spare, you see that it's got no subordinate clauses. It's got no expanded noun phrases. So it doesn't say when or where I am. It doesn't say what mood I'm in. It doesn't say whether I'm enjoying myself or hating doing it. So it's mysterious. It's spare. I'm trying to eat lettuce with a spoon. And people are going, well, why are you doing that? I mean, you know, use a knife and fork. Well,
that's
you know,
very reminiscent of the apocryphal story about Ernest Hemingway betting a group of his writing buddies that he could write a compelling story in just 6 words. Have you heard this story? And it's the for sale baby shoes never worn.
Lovely.
And then he leaves the bar a richer man because he wins the bet, because you have to agree it's compelling. And it makes you go, it takes you to the whole gamut of what could be possible.
Perfect analogy. That's it. So I'm quite often looking for little, very spare sentences, or very spare, might be, you know, 10 words, 20 words, or in this case, I am trying to eat lettuce with a spoon. Nine words, you see. So people say, well, that's not a poem. It's stupid and all the rest of it. But at the same time, if you sit and look at it, which is what Chinese poets and Japanese poets suggested that you do, is that when you're face to face with a haiku, which of course is based on syllables, 575, that you look at it and think about it. And as you think about it, you will find yourself thinking about time passing, maybe, or seasons, or the state of how absurd it is that we're on this earth, all sorts of things. And you don't have to have, you know, Paradise Lost, which is, you know, thousands and thousands of words long. You can express important and essential things, that's to say the essence of things, sometimes with, well, in this case, 9 words. So the actual absurdity of why is Michael trying to eat lettuce with a spoon when he could be using a knife and fork? Can't he find a knife and fork? Why not maybe not eat the lettuce? There's all sorts of things to contemplate. And it's also the idea that you're stuck doing something, which we are. Yes. We're all stuck doing something.
And as you say, life is absurd. It is.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So there's an example of one kind of poem that interests me at its very shortest form.
And now a quirky or unusual fact about you that we couldn't possibly know. And you've been giving us loads of these anyway. But a quirky or unusual fact about you, we couldn't know about you until you tell us, Michael.
Right. A quirky, unusual fact. I'd like to be able to show you this, but you'll just have to imagine it. I thought I might have had it, might have got it in the room. Just 1 second.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityCairo.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so when I was brought up in a place called Pinner, lived in a flat over a shop. And if you know anything about shops, out the back there are always yards. And then if the shops are at a kind of T junction, then there's a sort of square behind the shops. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to show it. You see, so there's a square behind the shops where the lorries and the cars turn up, the bin men come, the deliveries and all that. Well, that was my playground as growing up, was this effectively this quite big yard at the meeting of Bridge Street and Love Lane, where we lived in Pinner. And so in my mind's eye, I can go down the shops in Love Lane to the end to Bridge Street and then up Bridge Street, quite a few. So it's about, in all, probably about 20 or 30 flats over shops, all backing onto this square. And this alleyway, the surface of it was made up of pebbles, and very strange pebbles, a sort of khaki colour. My brother's a geologist and paleontologist and ecologist. That's what my brother's job is. I think he once told me that because of the way the glaciers operated, the way the glaciers were around London, they produced a certain kinds of gravel, and some of it are like little nodular pebbles. Inside, I think, there's a flint, but the outside of them is like very hard calcium. It's not chalk, but sort of calciferous stuff. And in the middle is flint. So that's what the surface of this thing was. It was made up of that. Well, I went there about a year ago because I was doing something at my old school. And most of it had been covered over with tarmac, but there was one bit of it that was still the pebbles that I played on 70 years ago. So I picked up one of those pebbles and put it in the pocket of my coat. And so I've got it in my coat. So when I want to remember Pinner, I can put my hand in my inside pocket in my overcoat and feel this little pebble that I must have played on hundreds of times with my friend Keith Townsend. We used to play cricket and football and all sorts of things there. And who I've never seen since we left there in 1962. I've never known what happened to Keith Townsend. Anyway, so I've got that pebble. So there we are. There's a little story.
And I hope you haven't lost it, by the way, because you tried to reach for it, but it's in your coat pocket, I think.
It's in my coat pocket. It's in the inside pocket of my big winter coat. And as you know, it's not winter now.
And when did you pick it up? Very recently, by the sound of it.
About less than a year ago, when some guys from the University of Westminster Film School made a film about me. Yeah.
Lovely, quirky or unusual fact. We have shaken your tree. Hurrah. Now we stay in the clearing, move away from the tree. And next we talk about alchemy and gold, please. No extra charge for the props. You're welcome. So right. When you're at purpose and in flow, what are you absolutely happiest doing, Michael?
Well, apart from writing, so let's leave that to one side, I guess it's being with my family. You know, I had my 77th birthday and we went to a Turkish cafe around the corner from us. And we sat there. And as I sat there, I looked up and down the rows at my family and, you know, with their partners and so on. And it just felt lovely. And then just this last weekend, it was my oldest son's birthday. And we sat in his garden and there was a blackbird trilling away in the background. And there was a beautiful cake with raspberries in it. And their daughter, my granddaughter, was running around in a sort of Queen of the Fairies dress of some sort. And there were people I didn't know. I met for the first time, and my other son and my wife and our kids, our youngest, that is, the one who called me an optimistic nihilist, and younger one, Emil, who's just finished at school. And it just felt beautiful and lovely. Anybody who enjoys family life, not everybody does, but if they do, then I'm just doing something very ordinary that millions of people are doing all around the world, just sitting, and when subjects come up, we kind of bat them around. And one moment we might be talking about Arsenal Football Club, and another moment we might be talking about music. My son's wife is very much into music. Another thing, somebody said, what are you doing next? And so I think I talked about a bit of writing that I've been doing, and talked a bit about radios or stuff. And then other people talked about what they were doing. And there was a couple of babies, sort of babies going into toddlers. And it was just bliss. It was just such a lovely, sort of relaxed kind of feeling. So that was beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
And how big is the Rosen clan when you're all together?
Oh, wow. Right. So I did have five children and two steps. And we lost Eddie. So that took it down to four and two. So the two steps, they're married and have kids. And then of my blood relations, as they say, I don't like talking in those terms. But anyway, my oldest, he has one child. So that's all making the family getting bigger and bigger. And then the other three haven't had babies yet. So there we are. There's quite a clan. And, you know, we've all got partners. So, you know, it's getting up to be quite a number. So when we have our celebrations, or indeed our commemorations of Eddie, so that's another thing we do. We all meet up very nearly around the time Eddie died, so that we can commemorate losing our Eddie. And we usually do that in a lovely, big, sort of spacious pub in North London on a Sunday lunch. And that's very good. It's very sort of full of families all kind of shouting and being jolly. And that cheers us up. So that's another occasion when we all meet up.
And if I could ask, what time of year is that, the Eddie Memorial Day?
Eddie died, do you know, he died in the night. And it's rather peculiar. I don't know whether he died on the night of April the 26th or the night of April 27th, because it was the middle of the night. You never know what the date is in the middle of the night. So it sort of slightly embarrasses me. But at the same time, I quite like the sort of indeterminacy of it, that there's this night when this terrible thing happened, and that I don't actually know the precise, you know, calendar date of it. It sort of doesn't matter. You know, we quite often think that what matters are dates, but actually what matters sometimes with experiences is this word you're using, the flow. So I remember the flow of feeling, and the tying it to April 26 or April 27 is kind of a distraction, almost like a fly has come into the room and get, don't forget April the 26th, don't forget April the 27th. And in a way, well, no, it doesn't matter. Actually, let me just hold on to my feelings of that time. And that's a bit more important. So one or other of those dates. So I think possibly it was technically the night of the 26th, and he probably died in the morning of the 27th. That's what I think happened. So there we are. I'm answering the question finally.
And I think there's been a very recent catharsis, as I understand it, in your book, Getting Better. There is a section in it where you, for the first time ever, have put the sort of, I suppose, the timeline, you've sort of aligned the journey of it in a way that you hadn't before as a bit of catharsis. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely right. I think I had it in my head, and I've written lots of little bits about how I felt or dreams that I have, or and I did a little book called Carrying the Elephant, which is based on a picture that I found in Paris of a man carrying an elephant. And when I saw it, I thought, that's me.
Wow.
Burden of Eddie. I don't mean Eddie's a burden. I mean the fact that he died is such a burden. I looked at it and thought, that's me. I'm carrying the elephant, and I've got to carry that for the rest of my life. And I bought the card. That is the card. It's fading a bit, which is a shame.
That's...
Here is Eddie, by the way. Here he is as we're talking about him. Here he is as a teenager. I remember thinking, so I wrote these poems about it, but they're fragments. And then I thought, as I sat down to do Getting Better, let's see what it feels like to write it out as the night the day before, the night, what happened, the morning, what happened afterwards, and something of how I've tried to cope with it. But laying it out in a line like that, it was like such a relief. It's very hard to describe. I mean, if people say, tell me, you know, awful, tragic things, I do say to them, just try writing down what happened, because part of the devil of it is you keep repeating it in your head.
Yes.
And when you write something down, sometimes it stops you repeating it. It's almost as I think you've released it and you don't have to keep repeating it in quite such a painful way. Until you've done it, and unless you've done it, you won't know the feeling. But anybody who's done it, and it could be the occasion when you broke your leg, you know, and I was walking down the road and then I fell down and broke the leg. And you hear people, they quite often tell you that story about how they broke their leg, and they'll tell it to you, if you know them well, about 20 times. And I sometimes, which is fine, but I sometimes think it's because they haven't written it down. And if they wrote it down, they wouldn't feel quite so compelled to have to tell it. And if they've told it 20 times, in their head, they've told themselves that story 100, 500 times. And that's where some of the pain comes in, through that repetitive telling. So one of the things about writing is that writing began because people wanted to preserve things they thought that they would forget, like the numbers of flour bags that they were loading onto ships, which is very hard to remember. So ancient Sumerian writing was numbers of flour bags, possibly so they could be taxed, or, you know, how much money they'd sold them for and so on. So in a way, though that sounds very, very mundane, very, very banal, and sort of like, what have flour bags got to do with somebody dying? Well, in a way, you are doing something similar. You're writing it down so you remember it, but also so you, in a funny sort of way, have it's less necessary for you to remember orally or mentally. And
in therapeutic terms, it's about carrying baggage. So flower bags, elephants, all speak to that, actually, carrying the burden of memory or the burden of pain. Or grief.
Yeah, another image I have is the idea that when you've got these feelings, it's a bit like a balloon. The air is in the balloon. The surface of the balloon is all tight. It's hurting. It's under strain. It's under stress. And then you release the air. And the balloon is just all soft and juicy. And the pain and the strain is gone. You've released that story. You've released the air.
So it was cathartic in that way.
Definitely.
And by the way, that could I ask for a copy of that photograph? I think that's absolutely fantastic. If you could take a photo of it, if you don't mind sharing it, if it's not too personal.
Well, the elephant.
I'll just explain why. That speaks to me very profoundly. Yes, I love it. Interestingly, I'm going to see my parents this weekend, and just in my sort of slight backstory very quickly, our family have always had that slight shadow over us because my sister died in a car accident in 1979. Like 1999 is a long time ago, but you'll never get over it. 79 is even longer ago, and I'm aware that, you know, the baggage is still carried. I'm a parent, so I know what it's like to lose a sibling, but not, heaven forfend, a child. So, you know, I understand the nature of grief, and that picture is very profound, and how it also just spoke to me. Thank you.
Yes, you find it online because it's an engraving from a La Fontaine fable. La Fontaine, who adapted Aesop fables into these famous things like the crow and the fox, maître corbeau sur un arbre perché tenait en son bec un fromage, maître renard par l'odeur alléché lui tient à peu près ce langage, maître corbeau que vous êtes beau. Anyway, that one. So La Fontaine did lots of those, and this one is not about a man carrying an elephant. It is called, I believe, something like...
This will help anyone listening to be able to do the same thing.
So the first bit is Les Deux Aventuriers. So that means the two adventurers. In French, you don't put the D in the word adventurer. So it's Aventurier, so I-E-R-S at the end. E, which is and in French. Le, L-E, Talisman. And that's the same word, same spelling as in English. So it's Les Deux Aventuriers et le Talisman, I think is how you say it in French, or possibly Talisman, I don't know. So Les Deux Aventuriers et le Talisman, Talisman. And I seem to remember the artist is called Jean-Baptiste. So that's Jean-Baptiste with an E on the end, Jean-Baptiste Oudry, O-U-D-R-Y. All right. Lovely.
So is he actually describing, is the picture of him carrying an elephant in the story a fable of two adventures?
Well, I have dug up the fable once, and now I've forgotten it. But I think in the fable, one of the people is carrying an elephant. If you go to Google Images and put in Les Deux Aventuriers et le Talisman, Jean-Baptiste Oudry, and the picture, in fact, is in the Musée du Petit Palais in Paris. So if you know Paris at all, there is Le Grand Palais, the big palace, which is huge, great big exhibition space. And then another lovely exhibition space called Le Petit Palais, meaning literally the little palace, where I think Quentin Blake once did an exhibition, which is rather lovely. And obviously that is there in that somewhere in an archive or possibly on the wall in Le Petit Palais. I haven't seen the original. So that is a gravure d'après Jean-Baptiste. So yes, that's right. It's an engraving after Jean-Baptiste Oudry.
Yes.
So there we are. So you can find that.
It's also a wonderful testament to the sort of the journey and the long tail of grief, because you found something recently, which then again spoke to you and filled in everything backwards. And that spoke to you again, because obviously one never overcomes that.
Yes. Well, I found it actually only possibly a few weeks after he died, because Zanna had the idea that we could go to Paris just to sort of lose ourselves or find ourselves or something. And there was no connection with Eddie, but just get away from people coming up to us saying, very sorry that Eddie died, which can, you know, can get to you after a while, because everybody who meets you goes, I'm terribly sorry, I'm terribly sorry, while you're busy going about life thinking, I don't want to think about it just for the moment.
Of course.
So we went to Paris and we just mooched about. And that was one of the things. I mooched into one of these, there's lots of lovely print shops and so on in Paris and selling things. And I remember finding this and thinking, that's me. C'est moi, as you'd say in French. I speak a bit of French. C'est moi. And I think, that is me.
Or you could have gone, nice.
In that I could have gone, nice, except I had already done it. Anyway, never mind that. Okay. So, and I just recognised me as being that man. Total identification.
What's really profound is how both the picture of Eddie and the elephant all this time on are still just by your right hand. That's so
absolutely. They're there. And they're leaning up against a tortoise. And this tortoise was given to me by the poets John Agard and Grace Nichols. And at first, when they gave them to me, I thought it was for my 50th birthday, I think. And I thought, what a strange thing to give me. And John, I think, was who explained that tortoises are much admired. They're patient, they're slow, they get there, they get what they need, they got a shell, they know to look after themselves. When people are after them, they just get inside their shells. And so it's very nice that carrying the elephant and a picture of Eddie are propped up on John Agard and Grace Nichols' tortoise.
Wonderful. And the fable that you talked about coming full circle, it's not the hare and the tortoise. There's lots to be said about being a tortoise.
Yes. In fact, I don't think La Fontaine wrote a version of that. I think he wrote versions of various of the Aesop fables, but not that one. I'm not sure that is an Aesop. Oh, it probably is. Yeah.
I think the hare and the tortoise is classically.
I think you're right.
I've suddenly realised I'm talking to a lecturer in children's.
No, I do sometimes forget my Aesop fables. And anyway, nobody knows who Aesop was, so yeah.
And now I'm going to award you with a cake, please, Mr. Michael Rosen. So,
lovely.
Obviously, I think you like cake because you talked about one nom 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 and you do chocolate cake, obviously. So would you like a chocolate cake? What type of cake would you like?
Actually, I would like a piece of chocolate cake. I do every now and then have chocolate cake. In between, don't tell anybody this. Can we keep this secret?
Yes.
I eat fruit cake. So chocolate cake, yes, I do like it, particularly if it's very dark and the spongy bit is actually sort of laced with chocolate in it. I believe it's called ganache. Anyway, so ganache chocolate cake, yes. Bit rich to have sort of like regularly. So in between, fruitcake. Thank you.
Fruitcake. And do we like fruitcake with a bit of cheese, please?
No. Okay. No, I just take it neat with, rather extraordinary, I don't drink tea or coffee, but I have fruit tea. So fruitcake with fruit tea, especially berry tea, often cranberry and raspberry. There we are. You can't get more specific than that, can you? So there we go. Fruit tea and fruit cake.
They are yours. If I am lucky enough to meet you again, by the way, we have met round about the time of you doing, there was a Viv BB Poetry Please event that happened way off in the late 80s, and we met. So
before I was born, before
I was born. Anyway, the cake is yours, the fruit tea is yours. Now you get to put a cherry on the cake in the form of what's a favourite inspirational quote that's always given you succour and pulled you towards your future?
I'm not sure I've ever had an always, but please don't laugh, but every night I play a song by Bob Dylan that is called Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. And this begins with the line, when it's raining in Juarez and it's Easter time. No, when you're, sorry, start again. The line is, when you're lost in the rain in Juarez and it's Easter time too. So now you've got to imagine the younger Bob Dylan, and he's not only singing, he's also kind of pleading. Okay, so I can't really do this, but it goes something like this. When you're lost in the rain in Juarez and it's Easter time too. Okay, it's not a very good imitation there.
No, very good. No. I liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It's very, very nice. Anyway, you think, well, what's inspirational about that? Well, the song is about, if you can say it's about anything with a Bob Dylan song, about somebody having uncomfortable, uneasy memories, experiences, dreams, until he realizes he has to get away and get back to New York City. And there's something about that song that in the last year has got to me completely. And I literally have to play it every night to just think about that way in which the kind of illness I've had. Okay, I'll try not to get emotional now. It sort of cuts you loose. That's a sort of phrase that comes from sort of blues and Elvis Presley and so on. Going to cut you loose. And that's connected with terrible things like slavery and coming out of the grim experiences of the South and the States. Going to cut you loose. But there was a way in which I had the sense that I lost connection with the things that matter. I told you, you said, you asked me what matters, and I said this lovely family thing. Well, I didn't have that in hospital. There was a lockdown. Nobody could come and see me. The first time I saw them all was they came in the garden when I was in a rehab hospital, and that was just incredible. So, but that was, I was had already been in hospital for 2 months. But when I came home, there was a way in which I wasn't the same as I was before. And so I was sort of cut loose from myself. Yeah. So I think I'm playing this thing. So I've given you this fairly inconsequential line, when you're lost in the rain in Juarez and it's Easter time too. And that's what Dylan can do. He can give you pictures. Look at that. You're lost in the rain. It's a place called Juarez, which, you know, for us over here, this side of the pond, we don't know where it is, but he's out of America. We know that. Juarez, it's in Mexico, I think. And it's Easter time too. Like, that should be nice. That should be fun, but it isn't. And so you say, well, how can that inspire you? Well, I tell you, it inspires me every night, not only to think about it, but also to write things. And in fact, what I've been doing is I've been creating a kind of late night tweets book. So every night after I listen to this, I write a tweet poem, like the one, you know, I'm trying to eat lettuce with a spoon. And I write these, and it's been inspired by this poem. So at the moment, it's that line. And also, of course, I know what's coming next in the song. And it has this incredible backing, you know, mixture of guitar and piano and drum and bass. It just, that does it for me. So there you go. You may think, well, you know, it's not very poetic or whatever. But the thing about Dylan is he can describe this dislocation, which for me is where I'm at a bit, much, much less so than when I came out of hospital. But there is still a part of me that feels dislocated from the person I was.
Almost a detethering, or as you say, a dislocation. Yes.
Yeah.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
Thank you for sharing that. That's very profound indeed. Have you ever seen or met Bob Dylan?
Seen him perform twice. Once in 1965 or six, I don't remember which. And then again about 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah.
Because it occurs to me, you should, because of who you are, you should write to him and say how it affects you. Because I think that's just such a wonderful. I mean,
well,
I don't know when he wrote it, but
the only problem with saying things like that to Bob Dylan is that he turns it all around, because he's a very paradoxical, quirky guy. So I think there's a recording of him singing it. I think possibly in Liverpool or somewhere, and you can find it on YouTube. And I think somebody shouts something either after it or during it, and he stops and he says, "Hey, man, hey, it doesn't mean anything." Well, you know, because, or it doesn't, it don't mean nothing, or something like that, he says in his own voice. And of course, I know what he means. He doesn't mean it doesn't mean anything. He says, don't try and make it mean something logical. Don't try and unpack it so that it all fits neatly, because that's not how I write or what I'm doing. I'm writing, well, use a clumsy phrase, mood music. I'm writing stuff that is the mood, not the specifics. Don't worry what I mean when I say the sergeant at arms or, you know, other phrases that he's got in the song. Don't worry about that. It's just, what does that conjure up for you? So so we talk about language, that language denotes. That's when we say, here is the table. But we also talk about language connoting. In other words, it has connotations. So if I say to you the table, well, the table that might come to your mind is the table you sat in next to when you were five. So it's got two elements to it. Table, that is the general thing that we all understand, the thing you buy, the thing you can go, you know, tables. We know what tables are. And then there's your table, the table in your mind, the table, you know, at school or at home or whatever. Well, Dylan, I think, is trying to write connotive poetry and music. So don't worry too much, but just see what the connotations are. So when you're lost in the rain, he's saying, well, go on, think about what it feels like when you're lost in the rain. And don't worry about Juarez. That was my thing. You could be, we're lost in the rain in Hyde Park or, you know, in the middle of Manchester. Don't worry about it. And then, and it's Easter time too. You know, it's got, he's not saying, think really about my Easter. Think about your Easter. So live in the land of connotation. And I find that really, really important and interesting. Yeah.
And how lovely. It don't mean nothing, but actually profoundly, it means everything, because it means everything to you help you reconnect.
Trying to say it's not denoting anything, it's connoting. So it doesn't mean anything. It feels something. I mean, another one of his songs I keep playing is that one that's got a chorus. You have to, you got to serve somebody, I think it's called. And it's a set of repetitive lines about you may be this kind of person, you may be that kind of person. But, you know, you either got to serve the devil or you got to serve the Lord. And it comes from his religious phase. I'm not religious. And I keep playing this thing because I keep thinking about these pictures he gives you of all these different kinds of people. In the end, he's sort of almost trying to say the whole world is in this song and these people don't figure out what their destiny is. Now, of course, some people are religious about it, but it's all right. I can take that. And I can thinking, well, that's right. We don't know what our destiny is. It's going to be, you know, you may be a good guy, you may be a bad guy. You know, I don't need to name names, but, you know, there's all sorts of people being in the news recently and people are struggling. You can see they're struggling with trying to figure out whether this person, I'm looking to name names, is a good guy or a bad guy. And you can see them grappling with it. And Dylan sort of draws you into that through these incredible pictures. He says, maybe don't worry about exact detail. Just think, I'm talking about the whole world here. Yes. Great, great poet. Wonderful, wonderful poet.
Wonderful. And what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given is my next question.
We're nearly there. Probably my dad. I once came back from school and I said, the teacher, we've just been doing, we used to be called RI, religious instruction. It then became RE, religious education, I think. Anyway, my day, it was either called RI or scripture. And my parents used to find this quite amusing. I used to come back and say things from it. And I said, oh, well, Miss Mount says that we should be like Jesus. And Jesus said, be meek. You see, and my dad went, woof, woof, got a bit sort of uppity about that. He said, be meek. And he walked around the house chomping on, be meek. And he said, no, I'd say, be curious. What do you mean? He said, well, just go on asking questions about things. You know, even when somebody's told you this is it, say, well, what is it? You know. And so I think that's probably the best piece of advice I've ever had, is go on being curious about anything and everything. You know, just keep inquiring, keep learning, keep trying to find things out.
And now, with everything that you've been through, through modern history, recent history, particularly the whole gamut of everything you've been describing, what notes, help or advice might you proffer to a younger version of yourself?
Younger version of myself, I think I thought and probably did almost up until recently that if you did something, that the outcome, you must, it must be kind of goal oriented, that you must know what the outcome is. You must want an outcome. And if the outcome isn't good, you're going to be disappointed. And if the outcome's not good, you'll be disappointed. If the outcome is good, you'll be really delighted. And I think I have spent my life being quite outcome oriented, which is okay. It has helped me, you know, do things and achieve things. But you have to give some space and time to things that aren't outcome oriented. You mustn't worry too much that everything's got a consequence and a phase that will happen after it. I mean, in a way, obviously, in life, everything does have a consequence, but just don't worry so much about it. And I think I have been sometimes always thinking, oh, well, if I do that, then that's what's going to happen. Or if I do that, oh, that might work. So rather than just concentrating on the thing itself and just letting it be, I mean, you know, there we go. We've got that wonderful piece of poetry from Paul McCartney, Let It Be. You know, he's described very profoundly that he had a dream of his mother and his mother's standing in front of him saying, Paul, let it be. What I take from that song is what I'm just trying to say now. There are times, instead of saying, right, I'm now going to lean over and pick up these glasses. Oh, no, I've dropped them. You're disappointed. Now I'm going to lean over and pick up the glasses. I've picked them up. That's brilliant. I've got the glasses. That's kind of goal-oriented activity. And you can, that could be writing a poem or it could be anything. But there are other ways when you can sort of sit in and, as Paul McCartney says, let it be. And that's hard. It's hard to do. Because, you know, we have to earn money and we have to get things done. We have to do the shopping. We have to wash up and all these things. And they're in a way, though they're kind of very ordinary, they're goal oriented. Yesterday I went shopping. You know what I did? I forgot to get my wife the new potato she asked me to get. So I came back to the boy. I said, I've done the shopping, love. I got you the salmon. I got you that. And she said, yeah, and the new potatoes. And I said, oh. And I could see she was disappointed. I said, I'll go out again. And she pleaded with me not to go. She said, I'll have chips instead. And she went to the freezer and got the chips. So, you know, these activities are goal-oriented. That was a failure. I felt bad about it. I still feel a bit bad about it, actually. No, I do. Because she was, I saw the look on her face. She was so disappointed. She had planned salmon and new potatoes. That was her meal. And I spoilt her image, her, you know, herself. You know, the things she'd planned for herself. And that was a shame. So I fully understand that life is full of these, but there are other times when it's good to just sit in and not think this is going anywhere. So that's my advice to this 15-year-old who is possibly thinking, oh, yeah, I'm training for this and I want to get in the team and I want to get in this play. And that's great. That was lovely. He was a lovely, enthusiastic sort of guy at 15. But other times I'd say, just sort of, sit there and see what happens. So there we are. So it's I'm going to take Paul McCartney's line. It's a great line. Let it be. You can't do it all the time, but just some of the time, let it be.
And we're ramping up to a bit of Shakespeare in a minute. But just before we get there, and this is about legacy, which I'll explain in a minute. And if I may now, this is the pass the golden baton moment, please. So as you've experienced this from within, who would you most like or who would most enjoy a good listening to in this format, would you say?
Who would like to listen to this podcast we're doing now?
Who would you like to pass the golden baton on to as to someone you think would like to have this experience within your network?
Oh, I see. Yes. Who would it do that? Well, I've met today for the first time a guy who calls himself MC Grammar. And he is a stunning performer of rap for kids, mostly. He has kids himself. And he does Bear Hunt and he does all sorts of others. He is already mega. He is going to be mega-er, I am sure. He has a huge future ahead of him. Wonderful young guy. As I say, he's already successful. So when you say someone's on the brink of success, it's a bit daft when they're already so successful. But he's a bit under the radar. I think he's doing stuff for Sky TV. You know, he's doing a huge amount. He does stuff and it goes viral immediately. I think he wanted to meet me because he's doing Bear Hunt and maybe there are some collaborations or collabs, as people call them.
Get down with the kids. I love that.
He said he's going to teach me how to be streets. So, yeah. So we had a lovely time sitting right here in this seat. And he was just there. And we had a great time. And I think you could have great fun talking to him. And, you know, he's a wonderful young guy with a very interesting background. And his heart is so totally in the right place. And he's a fantastic performer. So there we are. MC Grammar, which I put a couple of dedications in a couple of books. And then just to show how streets I am, instead of writing grammar as G-R-A-M-M-A-R, I wrote it as G-R-A-M-M-A. So in the London accent, you say grammar. I don't know if you've noticed this kind of front formation, it's called in phonetics. So it's a lot of speech with kids, it sort of comes out the front of the mouth. So you go, yeah, grandma, my mother. So it's quite funny. You hear it on a bus. I hear kids doing it. So when I wrote MC Grammar like that, he was he was so impressed. Yes. So there's me trying to kind of, you know, be streets. We're going to meet again. So we've got lots of lovely things that we'll probably do. So anyway, I hope you have some lovely fun talking to MC Grammar. Very, very serious. Very, very good fun. Fantastic performer. You can find his stuff on YouTube and if any of his other social media, other platforms are available. He is terrific.
And so your mission, if you should choose to accept it, is if you wouldn't mind furnishing with me with a warm introduction, then that will make it a bit easier. He doesn't have
to say yes. I will try to introduce you to MC Grandma.
Thanking you, MC Rosen. Okay, now we're ramping up to a bit of Shakespeare. By the way, this is a really authentic prop. This is the actual complete works of Shakespeare. It's not a first folio. I'm not going there. You can see
that. Did he sign it, by the way? It looks like he signed it.
Actually, it says Chris Grimes on there. 16986. It's when I went to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. And this is my actual well-thumbed complete works.
Fantastic. Beautiful. Yeah.
So it's not the first folio, and he didn't sign it, but that was a great question. But inspired by all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players, I'd like to ask you about legacy and how, when all is said and done, Michael Rosen, you would most like to be remembered?
Someone who gave things to people that they found funny and interesting. There we are.
You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@ThatChrisGrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com. That's abilitychiro.com.